Add to the latest coronavirus hotspots, Texas prisons. Some 70% of those tested have the coronavirus. What happens next? That story coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Jolie McCullough of the Texas Tribune talks about how Texas prisons are trying to tackle COVID-19 behind bars and what their options are now. Federal stimulus money for small businesses and Native Americans have both missed the mark. Also, why University of Texas researchers think the llama could be a pandemic hero. Plus, revisiting the border wall and a whole lot more as the Texas Standard gets started. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this fifth day of May, 2020. I'm David Brown. Hope your Tuesday's been a good one so far. Does Texas know something California doesn't? That's the headline of a new article in the Politics and Policy section of Bloomberg, a tale of two megastates, each with huge populations, each with outsized impacts on the nation's economy. One stereotyped as blue, the other stereotyped as red, and each with a different approach to the fight against COVID-19. As Texans were returning to beaches this weekend under Governor Greg Abbott's relaxation of stay-at-home orders, California's governor was ordering a hard close of some of the finest surfing beaches in the world. Whatever one thinks about the soundness of either approach, the split promises to translate a political divide into a new set of policy choices when it comes to public health science. As Bloomberg puts it, Texas is following the most permissive interpretation, while California is deploying just about the most restrictive possible. We may get a better sense of whether Governor Abbott is rethinking matters when he speaks to the press later today. Meanwhile, we've mentioned that at least two Texas cities are among the nation's hotspots right now, Amarillo and Abilene. And as Jolie McCullough reports for the Texas Tribune, a major outbreak in Texas's prisons, forcing officials to consider some difficult choices. Jolie, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
You're reporting that in Texas, at least 25 prisoners and staff have died and more than 1,600 have been affected by COVID-19. Is there any pattern that's discernible here, or is all prisons being affected similarly? What are officials saying?
Well, there's definitely some hot spots. So they come out with numbers every day. There's actually been two more deaths as of yesterday. So now we're at 27. There's a couple prisons in Palestine, especially the Beto unit, as they call it. And that's, you know, about 100 miles southeast of Dallas that has had hundreds of cases of the people that they've tested, of inmates who've had this virus. So there's a couple hot spots and several prisons that have more reported cases than not. But the big issue here is there's limited testing. So far, about 1% of the prison population has been tested. And, you know, we have a massive prison population here in Texas. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's about 140,000 people. And there's been about 1,700 tested. And 70% of them have had the virus, which is really high numbers compared to when you say Texas overall, it's about 8% of those tested have it.
What do health officials say about what's happening in these prisons? I know Governor Greg Abbott announced a statewide disaster back in mid-March, and at that time directed the prisons to cancel all inmate visitation. And I know that cleaning protocols were supposedly stepped up, too.
Yeah, so TDCJ, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, has been evolving. They've updated their policies. They've cut off visitation. They have since even stopped taking new inmates from county jails. So like, mm-hmm. say someone's in jail and they're sentenced, they're supposed to be transferred over to the state prison system. That has stopped happening. So they're trying to get a handle on this, but you know, there's over 100 prison units. And so a lot of people on the inside are saying, you know, you might have these policies from the top down, but they might not be making it to the staff at the actual units.
Has TDCJ talked at all about releasing some prisoners early, including perhaps elderly inmates or people close to finishing their sentences, or that something along those lines?
Well, so that's something a lot of advocates and a lot of like epidemiologists have said. You know, the only thing you can do is social distancing, and to do that, you need to get some people out of the prisons. And that is really up to Governor Abbott and the parole board, and neither one of them have made any indication that they want to do that. Governor Abbott has actually said the opposite of, you know, releasing dangerous criminals to the streets is not the solution.
What about prison workers? I mean, they presumably are going into these places that are now hotbeds for coronavirus. And then are they returning home?
Yeah. So that's one of the things that these epidemiologists say. Another thing that is needed is mass testing. You know, don't just test the people who are reporting that they're symptomatic. A, test employees, and also test anytime there's like a hot spot, like maybe at this Bito prison, like you should be testing the entire prison so you can kind of get a handle on who has it and try to figure out a way to manage it in that way. Because yes, a lot of people think of them, one epidemiologist said, as prisons are kind of isolated from society, but no, there are employees who come in and out all the time, especially in Texas. Prisons are often in rural areas with limited medical resources. And he said most of them throughout the country of these outbreaks have started with introductions from staff because they're coming in and out of the prison and they're in the community.
Is it clear that TDCJ has a plan here, you know, sort of a larger plan for getting control of the spread in its prisons?
Well, I mean, they have policies in place, but they're really at this point largely testing symptomatic inmates. And then, you know, if they need to, taking them to hospitals, they're trying to isolate those they have the virus. They're also putting many of the prisons on lockdown, which is, you know, anytime someone has the virus at the unit for 2 weeks, everything is kind of on hold. Inmates are kept to their cells or to their dormitories. They're fed in their beds. They don't really get to move. They're trying to limit movement. But, you know, infections are continuing to grow.
Jolie McCullough is a criminal justice reporter for the Texas Tribune. We'll link to her story over at texasstandard.org. Jolie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Federal government's on its way to making a record-setting $660 billion in loan guarantees intended for small business. The idea is to stave off economic ruin by providing backup to a sector that represents roughly 47% of the U.S. economy. Early indications are, however, that the plan missed not only the most affected areas, but also the most vulnerable businesses. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav has more.
Well, thank you very much, everyone. This is a great honor.
Last week, President Trump congratulated U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Small Business Administration head Jovita Carranza.
Have you gone to sleep in the last 2 weeks? I don't think so, right? You broke every single lending record, numbers of loans, amount of loans, small business.
The president was taking a bit of a victory lap on the government's ability to move more than $350 billion in tax dollars into the pockets of businesses through the Paycheck Protection Program. The funding was marketed as keeping small businesses afloat and their employees on the payroll. The bad press prompted audit threats from the Treasury and returned loans from large corporate actors. Now, early studies of the PPP are showing it may have missed the mark. A paper out from the University of Chicago shows, through Small Business Administration data and that of a payroll processor, the hardest hit areas didn't see more money, and in fact, less affected areas saw more.
It's not written anywhere that the goal of the program was to direct funds to the areas that were hardest hit.
Juan Granja is a professor of accounting and lead author on the study. The data shows states like Nebraska and North Dakota led in per capita loans, despite being less affected. Some of the reasons include businesses didn't have to prove severe hardship to qualify, the first-come, first-serve approach, and a focus on speed rather than targeted relief.
I think there was a clear trade-off.
Brett Theodos directs the Urban Institute's Community Development Hub. Its analysis also shows the first $349 billion in PPP money didn't get to the most affected.
So, for example, accommodations and food industry got only 9% of funds, despite by that point having two-thirds of job losses.
The second most amount of PPP loans went to professional, scientific, and technical services. That sector actually gained more than 7,000 jobs since March. Geographically, they saw problems with distribution. California represented nearly 15% of all unemployment claims the first month of the crisis, but its businesses only secured about 8% of the loans. While Texas received more of a share in PPP loans than it saw in unemployment claims. That didn't surprise Theodos or his colleagues.
I think in some sense, our expectation was that it would not be efficiently allocated to places of need. It would be more of a gold rush where whoever gets there first wins, regardless of how needy they are.
Rewarding the first through the door often means the most sophisticated, the better funded firms with good ties to banks that would be processing them. That often equates to more white and more wealthy. This should worry people, Theodos says.
We may be, as a result, entrenching inequities in who has capital in this country rather than ameliorating them. And it's worth remembering, this is an enormity of money. This is a mountain of money.
Early and anecdotal data has shown that less money's reached business owners of color and the smallest of small businesses, despite this being what many in the U.S. Senate were asking for when it passed. But the Treasury's administration has made that unlikely, even in the second round.
You know, from one perspective, this program did precisely what it was designed to do.
Noel Pollo runs the National Association of Latino Community Asset Builders,
which is to get money to protect the largest businesses in our country, and particularly the best customers of our largest banks. It did that brilliantly.
To really know how effective the program will end up, we need more time and more data. But the one thing we may never know is the racial makeup of those getting loans. The Small Business Administration took the unusual step of not collecting this information. I'm Paul Flab in San Antonio.
Wells Dunbar is our social media editor. What are you seeing out there, Wells?
Hi, David. A draft government report projects COVID-19 deaths could surpass 3,000 a day by June 1st. The Washington Post is reporting on the information, a leaked slide deck seemingly relying on internal Centers for Disease Control data. It also projects domestic COVID-19 cases will reach 200,000 by June as well. A scientist whose work informed the modeling called the projections one of several possibilities. We've shared a link to the report via Facebook and Twitter. Here's what we're hearing back. Edward Eichinger writes, as we collectively develop our virus-fighting muscles, the cost is going to be overwhelming. Hopefully the next virus won't be so hard to contain and stop. Vaccine or no vaccine, we need to learn to arrest these things before they get this far spread out. And Justin Klumper says, I really thought that we would be better at this. Doesn't anyone else think so? We kind of look incompetent as a nation right now. This comment on our Facebook page from Justin Klumper. Just a couple of the comments we're receiving out there, David. I'll be back
just
with more later. Yeah.
You know that's true. Of course, we need to hear from you, Texas. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells, as he says, we'll be back later in the show in about 35 minutes or so. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In COVID-19 hotspots like Wuhan, China, or New York City, death rates for patients on ventilators have been as high as 90%. At Parkland Hospital in Dallas, it's been much lower, about 25%. KERA North Texas contributor Sujatha Dand wanted to know why.
Todd Acock spends 12 hours a day, 4 days a week, taking care of the sickest COVID-19 patients at Parkland Hospital. He's been a nurse anesthetist for 19 years here, and he wanted to be on the front line.
You know, last night we extubated a patient who I intubated 4 weeks ago. So they're finally 4 weeks later getting off a ventilator, and it's very rewarding to see that.
Parkland has seen extraordinary results for COVID patients who are on life support. Almost 80% of the patients on ventilators are expected to recover. In fact, almost half have already gone home.
What is our process? What is our checklist?
Critical care physician Matthew Levino is the head of the medical ICU at Parkland. In March, he was charged with putting together a plan on how to handle COVID-19.
Not only how to care for these patients, but how to make sure that everybody that I was asking to come with me was actually going to be safe. And that was extremely stressful.
Lavino spent his days and nights researching what hospitals across the country and the world were doing. He handpicked what he considered were the best options to keep patients and staff safe. In less than 5 days, the third floor of Parkland Hospital was converted into a 100-bed tactical care unit. The large negative pressure room maintains airflow, preventing cross-contamination. The unit is set up kind of like a car wash, one way in and one way out, with an experienced surgical team helping staffers put on and take off their protective gear.
The fact that they're in their gear the entire time decreases the number of opportunities for mistakes in terms of getting in and out, decreases the amount of PPE that we're consuming, and again, it allows us to really optimally care for our patients.
Lavino says having all COVID-19 patients in one space allows physicians to easily move them to the ICU if their condition worsens. It's literally 20 feet away. He also identified a small intubation team, which includes Todd Acock. They handle the precarious procedure of placing patients onto ventilators.
I've been so impressed with the teamwork from literally the techs, environmental service, all the way up through the intensive care pulmonologist. Everybody truly works as a team. It is new for everybody.
Lavino believes creating this controlled, collaborative environment has been key to Parkland's high recovery rates.
We really went into this thinking that we were going to lose, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70% of the patients who require mechanical ventilation. Compared to what we were anticipating going into this, I think it's been a real source of kind of rejuvenation for the people who are down there.
Medical staff in some of the hardest hit hospitals worldwide have seen a much higher risk for infection compared to the general public. While Parkland couldn't release numbers of medical personnel who have been infected with COVID-19, Lavino says he feels that staffers at Parkland are no more likely to test positive than folks in the general public. Acock isn't surprised. He feels safer in the COVID unit than he does at the grocery store.
You know, we know what we're getting into. You take the time to do things the correct way and the best way possible, so you really eliminate all those risks as much as possible.
Right now, the COVID unit is three quarters full, but Parkland doctors say they're prepared for more patients as the state continues to reopen. In Dallas, I'm Sujatha Dand.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Native American communities have some of the highest rates of diabetes, heart disease, and asthma, all of which leave them more susceptible to the coronavirus. Native American households are often multi-generational, too, meaning elderly relatives who are at higher risk live with the rest of the extended family. Though the Indian Health Service is already underfunded, the recent economic stimulus packages approved by Congress, known as the CARES Act, allocated some $8 billion in stimulus money to 574 Native American tribal governments. But Jennifer Bender of HuffPost reports that the promised money has yet to arrive. Jennifer, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much.
Let's talk about the reasons for this missing money. If Congress said that these tribes were entitled to it, is there any question about whether or not they should be getting the money in the first place?
No, there's no question. They are entitled to federal funds, just like state and local governments are entitled to federal aid for something like a pandemic.
Well, now, wait, you said no, there's no question about it. But as I understand it, there was a lawsuit over this very issue. And the Treasury Department said, we don't see any reason we should disperse these funds.
So there was a lawsuit that gets kind of in the weeds where Alaska Native corporations were made eligible for to take some of this money from this $8 billion fund for tribal governments. Mm-hmm. And there was a lawsuit over it. It was between tribes. You had a division in Congress over whether that money should go to them. And there was a decision made that they are going to freeze any money to the corporations for now and deal with that part later, which means the government can now give all the money out as it should have. Just because of this lawsuit, it doesn't mean that that gave the government an off-ramp to not begin distributing this money. And they, the real reason it hasn't gone out is because the Treasury Department just does not know how to work with tribes. I interviewed Senator Tom Udall, who's from New Mexico, who is the top Democrat in the Senate who deals with tribes. And he all but said that Treasury Department doesn't know what it's doing. They were given this lump sum of money to give to tribal governments with an urgency behind it, because this is a pandemic that is disproportionately hurting tribes. But Treasury, they have to come up with a formula for distributing the money. And agencies like the Bureau of Indian Affairs knows this, and they know how to put together these formulas. Treasury does not. And so they've been leaning on these other agencies to help. These other agencies are already spread thin because they have other things they're doing during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, people at Treasury haven't been listening to what tribes have said that they need. For example, there was a piece of the bill that the Small Business Administration, which is a subset of Treasury, they decided that casinos should not be eligible for some relief in the bill.
Why not?
Well, there was a regulation that is sometimes applied that says businesses that get a certain percentage of their money from gaming activities are not eligible for federal aid.
Oh.
In this case, that was not meant to be the intended effect of this money. This money was supposed to go to tribal casinos because that is the lifeblood for many tribal governments. They make their money for hospitals and roads and things through their casinos. So the fact that the Small Business Administration decided not to let casinos be part of this pot of money, that was another way that Treasury kind of botched it for tribes and cut them out of getting relief that they really need.
From what I hear, it sounds like one bureaucratic misunderstanding or disagreement compounded on top of another bureaucratic disagreement, right? I mean, this seems very much a function of the bureaucracy's inability to process what Congress has ordered.
Welcome to the federal government. This happens a lot, but in this case, this is a matter of life and death for tribes. This is about money that is for emergency public health and economic relief. And it is just not getting there. And it is because of bureaucracy and a lack of understanding of tribes by the Treasury Department.
Jennifer Bender is a reporter for The HuffPost. We'll link to her story, Tribes Were Supposed to Get $8 Billion in COVID-19 Aid. They've gotten zero. We'll link to it over at texasstandard.org. Jennifer, good to talk with you. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes out to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee is this morning considering Texas Congressman John Ratcliffe's nomination for Director of National Intelligence. President Trump first tapped the Dallas area Republican for the role last summer, but he withdrew from formal consideration amid questions over his lack of experience. On Capitol Hill today, Ratcliffe assured senators he would be an impartial White House advisor.
Let me be very clear. Regardless of what anyone wants our intelligence to reflect, the intelligence I will provide, if confirmed, will not be impacted or altered as a result of outside influence.
If confirmed, Ratcliffe would replace Acting Director Richard Grinnell. Texas House Speaker Dennis Bonin is criticizing large retailers for failing to enforce social distancing measures among employees. The Angleton Republicans singled out stores such as Home Depot, Lowe's, and Walmart. Bonin told Spectrum News Monday that if corporate owners do not supply and require employees to wear masks and stay 6 feet apart, it could delay when smaller businesses are allowed to reopen.
I want hair salons and barbershops open. I want restaurants at 50% and 100% in-store dining. And those things aren't going to happen until the big box retailer, who's never had to shut down, has their employees follow these guidelines. And it's not a big ask.
Bonin's comments come just days after Governor Greg Abbott's executive order took effect, allowing some businesses to reopen at reduced capacity. It asks all retailers to keep employees at least 6 feet apart and encourages them to wear masks, although it's not required. Many Texans are wary of air travel and trips to the grocery store amid the coronavirus pandemic. That's according to a new survey of nearly 1,200 registered voters. University of Texas at Tyler political science professor Mark Owens conducted the poll. He looked at when people would be willing to fly again across different age groups.
Individuals who are older, in this case, are actually waiting most often to book their air flight after July 30th.
Majority of Texans over the age of 35 do not plan to take any flights until after that date. Owens also found people are still largely uncomfortable with going to the grocery store.
And individuals moving forward do feel more comfortable in opportunities right now of curbside shopping than they expect to feel comfortable again on the question of actually going into the store and shopping.
Only 16% of respondents feel extremely comfortable going to the grocery store. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron, Adler, Clough, and Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. There's not usually a silver bullet for something as complicated as a pandemic, but researchers from all fields of science have been fast at work down a myriad of paths in search of potential solutions. One effort going on right here in Texas that we can't help but pay attention to has to do with llamas. Could llamas help rescue us from COVID-19? Well, initial results of this research being published in the journal Cell today. To explain how this might work and how researchers got interested in looking at a llama in the first place, we turn to the leader of the U.S. half of this research team. Jason McClellan is an associate professor at UT Austin. Professor McClellan, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks very much for having me.
How did the llama wind up in your sights?
It's been known for a while now that llamas and other members of the camelids, such as alpacas and camels, in addition to conventional antibodies, like the kind humans make, they make those plus another one that is pretty unique. It's and they contain a portion that's much smaller than the corresponding fragment in human antibodies. And this small molecule, which we'll call a nanobody, is able to bind very small pockets and crevices on viral glycoproteins that could be just injected directly into humans. Or we could also take that small portion and fuse it to a constant fragment of the human antibody and also inject that into humans. And that could potentially protect them from coronavirus.
So this would be a vaccination.
It's like a passive vaccine. For a normal vaccine, like we generally think about, that's a form of active vaccination where you are injecting the pathogen or a portion of the pathogen, and you're letting the human body raise an immune response and develop its own antibodies. In this case, we're just directly injecting antibodies. So it'd provide an immediate but shorter term protection.
So where are you right now in testing? I understand that this particular line of research was built upon some previous research that enables your team to move rather quickly. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, we've been studying coronaviruses since 2013, making a lot of different reagents for some of the other well-known coronaviruses like SARS coronavirus that emerged in 2002, MERS coronavirus that emerged in 2012. And in this case, this antibody arose from that prior work where we were injecting this llama. Our colleagues in Belgium actually were injecting the llama with the MERS and SARS spike proteins to try and elicit these nanobodies. And it turns out that one of the nanobodies we had previously isolated against the first SARS coronavirus also binds to this new SARS coronavirus 2 that causes COVID-19. And so it binds well, it neutralizes the virus. And so now our colleagues in Belgium are scaling this up. They've identified an industry partner. They're optimizing it, making it more potent. And then hopefully soon we'll begin the various animal testing and human tests.
Do you have any sort of timeline on it? I mean, if everything goes smoothly, how far off do you think you are from being able to offer this?
Still probably at best a year away, just because we're still pretty early in the preclinical development. You have to make various cell lines to produce the molecule at high enough concentrations and yield, and then just going through a phase one, phase two, phase three, that just takes time in the 12 to 18 month time frame.
I want to ask one more question about llamas, because obviously that's what a lot of people are sort of tapping into here, the possibility that llamas could help out. Is it true that there was one specific llama that inspired this current research?
Well, we've been using one llama for a while. Her name is Winter, and she's helped us on a previous project on respiratory syncytial virus. And we inject her with the various proteins. Her body makes antibodies against them, and then our colleagues are able to isolate and pan them. We help characterize them, and it's really worked well. There's a lot of interest in these camelid nanobodies. In addition to llamas, sharks also make these types of antibodies as well, but llamas are much easier to work with.
Silly question, but who takes care of the llama?
I believe it's on a farm somewhere in Belgium.
So you're not having to personally, like, take her home every night or something?
Unfortunately, no. Yeah, we get pictures sent of her, so we know what she looks like.
Jason McClellan is an associate professor in molecular biosciences at UT Austin and part of the international team looking at llama antibodies as a treatment for coronavirus. Professor McClellan, thanks again.
Thanks so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose fight against cancer includes telemedicine. At-home, virtual visits with doctors help patients keep appointments while continuing to practice safe social distancing. Learn more at texasoncology.com.
Did you ever sit straight up in bed with something circling around your head and you swat at it as it whizzes by and it's just one pesky little fly? You shake your head and twitch your nose and settle down to sweet repose. And when you're just about to doze, fly trouble.
My name is Wizzy Brown and I'm with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service and I work with insects.
Fruit flies are a great insect to talk about pretty much any time because they can be around any time of year and they are going to be essentially attracted to rotting vegetation of some sort. I found a bag of potatoes that I had forgotten about and there were just thousands of flies coming out of that. They can lay, if they're left to their devices, they can lay up to 500 eggs, each fly, and it only takes about a week for them to go from egg to adult. So when you're dealing with a problem like fruit flies, you need to take steps to, one, avoid them. A lot of times when I go to the grocery store, I'm eyeballing the fruits and vegetables section closely to see where I see the fruit flies. And if I see any, I decide to go and get something else. They can also, the adults, fly in from outside. If they happen to be in vegetation that you're growing outside, then they can come indoors from that way and start an infestation as well. So the most important thing, other than avoiding them in the first place, is locating the source of where the larvae are and then getting rid of it by either disposing of something or cleaning something up in the case of a spilled item or organic matter that has built up in an area. Especially like with garbage disposals, if you have something down in the disposal, like a lemon didn't get completely ground up. The other huge one for fruit flies is going to be recycling areas. And that also includes not only the recyclables, but also cleaning your recycle bin on occasion. I'm not saying you have to clean it every time. I certainly don't clean mine every time. But I try to do that when you start seeing funk build up. And you could just take it outside and take a scrub brush and dish soap to it and then hose it down. The adults can be trapped, and you can actually create your own trap. You will create a little cone-like funnel out of a piece of paper and then tape that together into the cone shape. And then you can set that into a cup of some sort and then put a little bit of cider vinegar in the bottom of that. But if you only get the adults, you're going to continue to have a problem until you find where they are coming from and get rid of that. The eggs of the fruit flies are going to be probably too small for you to see with the naked eye. You would be able to see some of the larval stages, but most people don't pay attention. I remember I opened a box of raisins and I was eating them. And when I got, of course, to the bottom and I had like four or five raisins left and I'm trying to dig them out, I like see these little larvae in there. And I was like, yeah, okay. It kind of put me off of raisins for a while.
I'm Wizzy Brown for the Texas Standard.
Wizzy Brown is a program specialist for the Texas A&M AgriLife Service and our go-to insect expert. Something bugging you? Send us a line on social media or email us texasstandard@kut.org. It's been said that Roger Horchow, who died in Dallas Saturday at age 91, invented the luxury mail order catalog. Decades later, he revived old-fashioned glamour as the Tony Award-winning producer of the musical Crazy for You. But KERA's Jerome Weeks reports that friendship may have been his greatest talent.
A job at Neiman Marcus brought Roger Horchow to Dallas in 1960 with his wife, Carolyn. He'd already been working in stores in Ohio, but joining Neiman's would prove pivotal. He became the store's vice president of mail order sales.
He actually joined my father on a trip to Asia.
Richard Marcus is legendary retailer Stanley Marcus' son and the former CEO of Neiman's.
And the world just got kind of bigger for him, realizing there's a sourcing opportunity that he, I think, wanted to run his own show.
That show was luxury mail order. At the time, store catalogs just sold what anyone could buy in the store. Horchow believed a retailer could reach a new market if the catalog offered items you couldn't get anywhere else. When Neiman's didn't pick up his idea, Horchow left, and in 1973 scraped together enough money to start the Horchow Collection. It became a stylish success because of its exclusivity. Horchow tapped into Asian, European, and Latin American markets for handmade specialties most Americans couldn't get. Sally Horchow, the youngest of Roger Horchow's three daughters, recalls what it was like growing up in a world market.
The biggest effect that his building the Horchow Collection had on me and my sisters was the influence of all these incredibly interesting people from all around the world who used to visit our house.
The knack Horchow had for befriending people all over the world was a source of success in retail and the theater. He became famous for it in 2000 when Malcolm Gladwell profiled him in his bestseller, The Tipping Point. Gladwell handed Horchow 200 random names from the New York phone book. Horchow knew almost half. This is Gladwell from the audiobook.
I kept asking Horchow how all of the connections in his life had helped him in the business world, but the questions seemed to puzzle him. He didn't think of it as a business strategy. It was who he was.
In 1988, Horchow sold the Horchow Collection to Neiman Marcus. He lost his wife Carolyn to cancer in 2009. The two had become philanthropists, contributing to the Dallas Museum of Art and UT Southwestern. And Roger Horchow was a longtime member of KERA's board. But Horchow also turned to a childhood fascination. It was a story he often told. In 1934, the composer George Gershwin visited his parents' home for an impromptu concert.
I was upstairs, I was 6 years old, and I heard this wonderful music, and it was George Gershwin playing this very piano.
Horchow had invested in Broadway shows before. But in 1992, he created A Dream, his very own Gershwin musical. Crazy for You was a revised version of an earlier musical, but it was packed with what Broadway was once celebrated for, joyous music, infectious dancing. It ran for 4 years and won Horchow the first of his two Tony Awards. Sally Horchow says people often puzzle over why her father would be attracted to selling luxury goods and creating musicals. She says they come from the same impulse.
Just all the things he got involved with were about giving joy to others. It really is amazing. Whether it was beautiful things that people have in their homes or creating the gift of theater.
Morton Meyerson, the former head of EDS, says his friend Roger Horchow had a dry wit that charmed people, but he also had a laser-like honesty.
Roger cut to the quick. He went to the core of the apple and didn't mess around.
Sally says that's how her father handled his cancer. He refused to linger. Thursday, he learned it was inoperable. Friday, his daughters held hands by his bed and shared stories. Saturday, Horchow took what seemed his last breath, then another.
My sister said, he's not going. And Reagan said, Sally, sing to him. And I started singing, I'll Build a Stairway to Paradise by George Gershwin. I'll build a stairway to paradise with a new step every day. We hummed the rest and told him, Dad, it's time to take your final bow. Go. And he did.
Roger Horchow died hearing George Gershwin. I'm Jerome Weeks for the Texas Standard.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. While much of the country has been on lockdown, construction of President Trump's border wall has been accelerating. As Democrats on Capitol Hill have called for a complete stop because of the coronavirus, President Trump is using that same rationale to justify continued work on that wall, as Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leanos Jr. reports.
For the last year, Naida Alvarez has been fighting border wall construction that is expected to cut through her property. Her family has owned 8 acres of land along the Rio Grande and Starr County for decades. 3 generations of the Alvarez family live here, including her father, who recently saw a caravan of trucks drive by.
So he comes back home and he says, go check it out because they might be jumping the fences again.
She had a hunch that the people her dad saw might be government workers. Alvarez stepped out onto her porch to check it out.
They were in there with several big trucks, some sort of machinery. I felt insecure knowing there were people next to us. You know, we are supposed to be in quarantine and we have stay-at-home orders here in the county of Starr. I don't know who these people are, where they've been, or what they have.
Alvarez took a photo and sent it to her attorneys. Turns out she was right. They were government surveyors collecting data for upcoming border wall construction, something she and a dozen landowners are fighting in court. Ricky Garza is with the Texas Civil Rights Project, which represents the South Texas landowners.
Well, we had seen 6 cases filed some months, most months 3 or 4. We saw 13 new cases filed in March, which was a record and which was the most we had ever seen.
Garza says the coronavirus pandemic has made it hard to effectively meet with clients, and he thinks that's why the government is doing this now.
We think they're taking advantage of the pandemic to go after people's homes when they should be sheltering in place. I was pretty shocked when I first saw that the curve of cases, it looks like the it looks like the coronavirus infection chart.
It seems and feels so unfair.
Lakin Jordahl is a borderlands campaigner with the Center for Biological Diversity. He travels along the southern border documenting the construction of the border wall and talks to communities affected by it.
It's infuriating to see wall construction actually ramp up, actually be accelerated, when the people who are fighting wall construction are now required to do that from the confines of their living rooms.
Protests and rallies are out of the question right now due to the pandemic. Jordahl says border residents he's spoken to have seen the ramping up of border wall construction. He says since the pandemic started, the federal government has announced about 200 miles of border wall that will be expeditiously built, and it is waiving dozens of laws to build it.
And across the border in Arizona and California, we've seen this massive influx of construction workers into our border communities. These workers are coming from all over the country. They're crowding into hotels and grocery stores, exposing residents to increased risk of infection.
Naida Alvarez in Starr County isn't surprised the government is continuing with its project even during this difficult time. Her experience so far hasn't been good. Like last year, when her mom was dying of breast cancer, she says the Army Corps of Engineers kept calling every day.
So finally, I told the lady I was talking to, I said, like, what is it that you don't get? you know, we're busy. And I told her, why don't you call me next Monday? You know, my mother's going to die any minute now.
Alvarez told them they'd be done with the burial by the end of the week.
And guess what? That Monday morning, the first call we got, it was from the Army Corps of Engineer people, again, trying to get their signature that they want for the access to the property.
Alvarez says she'd like to see the money that's going to border wall construction instead be used to battle COVID-19. The Army Corps of Engineers said in a statement that its contractors are instructed to comply with CDC, state, and local guidelines. Customs and Border Protection says the pandemic shows that it's important to, quote, have full awareness of who and what is coming across our borders. CBP says it remains confident that it will build 450 miles of border wall by the end of the year. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Mission.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is monitoring the talk of Texas on this Tuesday. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. Yeah, hearing from some folks about that story we just heard about the ongoing border wall construction in parts of Texas. One comment from Facebook here from John Soyring. He says that the taxpayer funds being used to construct a wall should be redirected to battle the pandemic. He adds that a true wartime federal administration would redirect funds to the right battle, referring again there to the coronavirus pandemic. And of course, all the continued chatter on social media continues to pertain to coronavirus and COVID-19. Also seeing lots of discussion about another story from earlier in the show, the spread of COVID-19 in Texas prisons. One tweet here from listener Bix Jax. He writes, 70% of prisoners tested are positive for COVID-19. This is morally indefensible, referring there to some findings from federal prisons that the Federal Bureau of Prisons saying that 70% of inmates tested do indeed return a positive result. Also, a sobering comment here from Maravetta. She writes that she has heard that some prisoners, they don't even have soap to wash their hands. Instead, it's not given to them. It's available for purchase at the commissary. Obviously, lots of people questioning whether all that could be done to prevent the spread of coronavirus in prisons is actually being accomplished, David.
I am seeing a story that's unrelated to COVID-19 here that seems to be making headlines. Has to do with John Ratcliffe, the congressman who has been picked for intelligence chief. He apparently is facing a panel on Capitol Hill right now. The Texas congressman who was first nominated for director of national intelligence, well, that nomination fizzled. And he's facing skeptics again during his confirmation hearing for this new post. Todd Gilman is reporting now for the Dallas News. You ought to check it out. It's high drama, apparently, up there in Washington, D.C.
I believe it. Yeah, interesting. You know, I'm reminded of a story I saw yesterday about Representative Ratcliffe from the Daily Beast. You know, active on Twitter, and they report that John Ratcliffe's campaign Twitter account follows several conspiracy-minded Twitter accounts, such as JFK Jr. conspiracists, people of the so-called Q conspiracy involving the president. So some really interesting strange bedfellows there on Twitter. I'll share a link to that on our own Twitter account, this reporting from the Daily Beast. You know, another story that we've talked about some earlier this week, people continuing to talk about it on social media, the potential reopening of Texas universities and colleges as this wears on. Interesting tweet, or rather a Facebook comment here from a listener, Brian Jackson. He says, I don't see how one would slowly open a university when local, state, and national decision makers are putting their own economic timetables up against the viruses, and not to mention how one would go about physically retrofitting a university to make it where social distancing could not be impeded. This will be quite interesting to watch.
Yeah.
That last bit reminding me of something I saw there about, you know, in some Texas communities, arguments over school districts, whether or not we should close some schools. Perhaps keeping those additional campuses to facilitate social distancing might be something leaders look at.
What do you think, Texas? You know what to do. Reach out to us on your social media platform of choice. We're out of time for the big broadcast. The news continues at TexasStandard.org. Till tomorrow, I'm David Brown along with Wells Dunbar wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.